there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your calls and emails. Wow, what a wonderful list of things on offer in the next hour here on Ask Dr. Dawn. I hope you'll stay tuned and maybe even call in or contribute. And before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So, of course, we can't not talk about the imminent vote tomorrow on the first step, and I do mean the first little baby step in maybe rationalizing healthcare insurance and let's call it healthcare distribution. I think that's probably the best word to talk about it. Years ago, gosh, back before I even finished residency, I spent a lovely month doing bioethics in Texas, which was an interesting place to do it. And I had Professor Tristram Engelhardt. I still remember him because he's this tall, lanky guy, advisor to presidents, you know, very tall, lanky Texan in a three-piece suit with cowboy boots. He was really quite the dashing figure. But he made us ask questions about things like distributive justice and the basis for society's obligations. What does a right to healthcare equal an obligation for society to provide it, and if so, under what circumstances? And after a month of thinking hard about these questions, it sort of seemed to me that you needed to provide a basic minimum standard of healthcare to everyone in a population, that was in fact in the interests of society, and that basic minimum standard didn't necessarily need to be a Cadillac plan, but it did mean care for diabetes, care for high blood pressure, care for pregnancies, the things that are the high impact, high cost sorts of illnesses that will cause a lot of death and disability and suffering, and therefore are things that people have a right to expect to be insulated against by their government. Well, here we are, more than 20 years later, and we're still trying to get to that point as a culture. A lot of other cultures have managed to get there, but we're still having the discussion about whether or not this is somehow intrinsically un-American, and of course having the discussion about whether it's going to be a government takeover of healthcare, and the discussion about whether it's going to cost too much. Of course, it's a large and complicated topic, but I think we've lost our way, particularly with the scrutiny that's being placed currently on the political process and the debate about the cost, the money. And, you know, I just wanted to put one thing in perspective here. The actual cost of one fighter plane, this is an F-35 Joint Strike fighter plane. They cost $50 million each when they were ordered back in 2001. But guess what? Actually, they're going to cost $113 million each. And the Marines, Air Force, and Navy are planning to buy more than 2,000 of these. So now we're at $223 billion, which is like a third of what healthcare for all would cost. Just what the Congressional Budget Office has said about the bill that they're voting on tomorrow is that it's going to cost basically about three times the cost of this one weapon system that we're planning to buy. And, you know, the Cold War is over, and these fighter planes are just, I don't think they're going to be particularly effective fighting Al-Qaeda or international terrorism, which is probably the big threat. I don't think we necessarily need these fighter planes. Can we take back the money? Let's at least take back the $600 million of bonuses that the company, which is now 3 years late on delivering these things, was supposed to get. Performance bonuses, Yeah, well, we promised. It's in the contract. We have to give them these performance bonuses, even if they don't perform. Oh, God, help me. Anyway, what we need to do is rethink our values and remember that the child that your tax dollars are giving prenatal care to is very likely going to grow up and be the doctor who is writing your drug prescription when you're old. Do you really want that person to have attention deficit because they didn't receive proper prenatal care? Do we really want a whole generation of children who are less healthy than their parents, this generation that we're looking at right now? We've got to put the brakes on the direction that we as a society are heading. And this bill, for all of its flaws, for all of its dirty laundry, for everything else that's going on, is, as I said at the beginning, a baby step in the right direction. We really need to get something passed and hold your nose, as they say, and take that first baby step, because once we have this precedent, it will get better. It, honest to God, will get better. And we need to make this change as a society. We really do. And we're going to Dana in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dana. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I really appreciated your soliloquy. I honestly haven't known how I felt anymore about the health care bill, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate it. I wanted to ask you this morning for a protocol on managing blood pressure naturally.
Okay, meaning without pharmaceuticals.
Yes. What would be the things you take?
Okay.
You know?
So first thing is lifestyle. High blood pressure is a degenerative disease. And most cases of high blood pressure, not all, there are some secondary surgically treatable causes of hypertension, but most cases of hypertension are because the inside lining of the blood vessels, the endothelium, has been sick for 5 or 10 years. And the very first indications of endothelial dysfunction are a blood pressure that goes up and stays up under circumstances of adrenaline. So if you have a perfectly healthy physiology, then when your adrenal glands put out adrenaline, that is a signal to the blood vessels. It triggers an initial contraction of the blood vessels, and then almost immediately a burst of nitric oxide from the inside of the blood vessels, the lining of the inside of the blood vessels. Those are called endothelial cells. These are metabolically active cells. They're not just a wall, not just a passive barrier. They're actually extremely active in regulating, among other things, your blood pressure. So these cells release nitric oxide very rapidly. Nitric oxide relaxes the blood vessels. This is why we give nitroglycerin to people who are having a heart attack, is to open up the blood vessels. In the early stages of hypertension, those cells become sick. And one of the very first signs of endothelial dysfunction, and it'll happen about 10 years before you see the high blood pressure, is erectile dysfunction. So men in their 40s or 50s who are starting to have problems getting an erection, or who are not getting as good, quote-unquote good, we won't go into the details about what good means, but as good an erection as they used to, should see that as the endothelial cells saying, help me, which means change your diet, start exercising, lots of fruits and vegetables. And this has been scientifically proven. There's something called the DASH diet, which was studied, and I think the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually did the research on this. But if you eat 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and a serving is generally half a cup, you can lower blood pressure just by doing that.
Wow.
So the DASH diet, look it up and follow it. So it's roughly 7 servings of fruits and vegetables, more if possible. A certain amount of dairy. Now remember, it's Department of Agriculture, so there was a political fix in on dairy. But essentially what you want is the calcium. So you need good levels of calcium every day, lots of fruits and vegetables, and reducing salt. There is so much sodium in prepared foods, and that includes restaurant foods, and anything that's processed, anything that comes in a package. Basically, if you have to unwrap it and what it's wrapped in won't biodegrade, it's probably too processed.
I have discovered that.
Yes. So you have to go off fast food and you have to go off packaged food. And, you know,
do you take like omega-3s or anything?
Oh, we're only getting started here.
Oh, okay.
But I'm kind of doing it in order of importance.
I'm sorry.
So you fix the diet. You get off of the Frankenfoods, which is virtually every convenience food, almost. The carrots that are already pre-cut and wrapped in plastic, okay, fine. Although they've lost a lot of their nutritional value, they're still not going to raise your blood pressure. Then you go to, okay, what supplements? And bar none, the most important supplement for blood pressure control is magnesium. Magnesium levels in our diet, particularly if we eat processed food, are less than optimal. And most people in the alternative world are saying now that the magnesium to calcium should be 1-to-1, not 2-to-1, which is the conventional medical. So you take more magnesium, and you need to find a form of magnesium that's easily absorbed. I like magnesium glycinate, but there is also magnesium citrate, there's magnesium gluconate, there's lots of different forms of magnesium.
Can you take too much? Or
if you take too much, you'll get the runs.
Oh, okay.
So you break the dose up. I like glycinate because it also has a kind of a psychological calming effect, which mm-hmm. most of us need because we're in too hyperstimulated a culture. So you counteract that with extra magnesium, and you'll probably sleep better as well.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we haven't got anywhere near drugs, and we've already probably got a 50% chance of fixing your high blood pressure and getting those endothelial cells working. Now, the next thing that I look at is L-arginine, capital L-arginine, which is an amino acid. L-arginine is a precursor to nitric oxide. So if you raise L-arginine levels in the bloodstream, it helps those endothelial cells make the nitric oxide to counteract the adrenaline. And if you're doing the magnesium, your blood vessel walls are softer, the muscles don't go into spasm as easily, so you've reduced both the source of adrenaline, because I said it's calming, and also you've got a physiological effect on relaxation of the blood vessel walls.
And how much of that would you take?
The L-arginine doses vary. Most people are working at the 3,000 to 4,000 milligram a day.
Okay.
And the only caution around L-arginine is if you have a history of oral herpes or genital herpes,
mm-hmm.
you might increase your chances of getting an outbreak. So you would need to take supplemental lysine to kind of balance that out, because you're creating an imbalance, which is not a harmful imbalance except if you have that tendency, and then you might want to be preventative there. You won't absorb as much lysine when you take in the arginine. So if your stomach is full of arginine, then when it gets to the small intestine, you will absorb less lysine. So you could become deficient in lysine if your only protein meal is also when you take your arginine supplement. Otherwise, you're unlikely to become lysine deficient. But that's the other proviso when you start doing megatherapy with amino acids, is physiologically the way amino acids work. If you are taking, like, let's say the circular amino acid, the one that have a benzene ring, not a benzene ring, but a ring. If you have a ring, then a certain enzyme absorbs that amino acid. It's a carrier protein, and all the ones that have a ring compete with each other to go through that enzyme.
Mm.
And then all the ones that are X-shaped, which if I remember correctly, lysine and arginine are shaped like a T, and the T-shaped ones use a different enzyme system to get in through the small intestine. So if you have a whole bunch of the arginine, then you won't necessarily get any lysine through.
Mm, okay.
So you have to watch that aspect of it and balance it out. Okay, then the next step would be diuretics. There are a lot of natural diuretics out there. Chamomile, for example, is a good diuretic. Mini herb teas. Parsley tea has been traditionally used to lower blood pressure as an herbal medicine. And again, most of its action is probably as a diuretic. That's first-line therapy for hypertension, natural therapy. You get through all of that and you're still having trouble, then maybe you have to use drugs.
And you don't use the omega-3s?
The omega-3s. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, I do. And I forgot those. Data is mixed on whether omega-3s directly lower blood pressure, but I always put people on omega-3s. I would think everybody needs to be on omega-3s. I'm a great fan of them.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And that's it?
That's the start. That's a good...
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You talked about blood pressure last week, and I kept waiting for a natural thing, and I thought, oh, this week I got to hear it.
Well, there you go. Thank you very
Bye.
Much for asking. Bye-bye. And we're going now to Pedro in Salinas. Hello, Pedro. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a physician, and like you, and I want to thank you for raising awareness of the importance of distributing health care to all of us.
Yes, thank you for calling. And I always feel flattered when I get a call from another physician. What's it like for you over there in Salinas?
I work for the Mexican field workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing that for the last 14 years. I'm a family physician. And I'm you can see from my accent, I'm not from this country, I'm from Spain. And I wanted to just make one point. My wife is from Japan, and in Japan, it's very different than here. And you don't understand why we are still so behind. In our countries, healthcare is a human right. The Constitution acknowledges that everyone should have access to healthcare. It doesn't matter whether we are documented or undocumented. It doesn't matter whether we have money or we don't. We have access to healthcare the same way that we have access to education. And after living here for 20 years and loving this country to the point that I have moved and immigrated here, I still don't get it. Still don't get it why we don't acknowledge that healthcare is a human right.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're a Republican, independent, or Democrat, whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you or any of the callers can enlighten me, because honestly, it's very painful to try to provide health care in these circumstances. Sometimes I even think about going back to my country and move away, because it's very, very painful as a physician to witness the injustices that we witness every day. People,
yes,
basically don't get the health care they need, and as a consequence, they suffer painfully, and their families suffer, and we as society, we suffer too.
Yes.
So I don't know. I wasn't born in this country, I'm not trying to criticize this country. I say this is my new country, and I love it, but I still don't understand why we are still so far behind in this issue.
I want to just comment on what you're saying a little bit, because I think you bring up an important point, and it highlights maybe the answer to your question as well. The thought goes something like this. This bill that they're voting on tomorrow, it completely excludes undocumented workers. It basically says that if you are undocumented and earning your own living here, the bill will not let you purchase health insurance through the exchanges. In other words, we're not even going to let you pay for your own health care through the exchanges because you're undocumented, which is nuts, because then you're undocumented, so you can't afford health care. You aren't allowed to purchase it. So then you're going to get sick, and you go to the emergency room where there's a law that says that we have to take care of you whether you're undocumented or not. We've just prevented somebody from paying for their preventative care and forced them to go to the emergency room where we will be obligated to take care of them in the most inefficient, expensive way possible, not to mention the fact that when you allow someone to become very sick, they don't generally bounce all the way back, particularly with these sorts of diseases that we're thinking about, diabetes, hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
So how nuts is that? And this was a huge political football, and the reason it's not in the bill is because it was a deal breaker. And that goes back, I think, to why we don't have a right concept of a right to health care in this country, even though it's blatantly obvious that we need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to do with the political structure of this country and the polarization and vilification that has been going on since the 1930s. And the opportunity, there have been two windows of opportunity in the last century. One of them was during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Depression in the 1930s, there was this terror of communism. That was after Russia had gone communist. The unions were organizing a lot, and there was obviously economic unrest. And so the conservatives' forces in this country were very worried about a communist threat. And they saw healthcare as one of those places where providing this right globally would be a foot through the door of communism, that this was somehow synonymous. So they coined the term socialized medicine. It actually goes back to the 1930s. It's an earlier term. It came up again a lot in the 1960s when they were debating Medicare. And in the 1960s and the late 50s, there was another opportunity to do this. And this is when Europe pretty much did it. Europe did it after World War II, in England anyway, and many other countries. And when you're cleaning up from a major war, you it's in the political interest of the country to keep the population as healthy as possible. So even the conservatives got behind national health care in Europe. But here, they were insulated from that. There hadn't been as big a blow to the population's health. And it was communism. There was this huge red menace that was the Soviet Union. And remember, Stalin was a pretty scary guy. So I can imagine it was fairly easy to get paranoid about communism with, you know, Stalin. I mean, the current communist leader kind of creeps me out too, but that's a different conversation. Where I'm going with this thought is that I believe that there's something intrinsically bad about our particular system of government when it comes to these sorts of things, that it allows itself to be distorted in a way that the more parliamentary systems don't. I think the parliamentary systems have more inertia and a natural centralizing influence, whereas the way our give and take of government is, it's more innovative, but it also is easier to block progress on these fringe issues which inflame a certain small percentage of the population. And I think if we had a different political system, people would be able to ignore that fringe. And here the fringe is actually given a great deal more power. That's why we get this nonsensical sort of proposition where even if you want to buy health insurance, if you don't have papers, you can't. And it's like, what's up with that? It's so the guy from Arizona doesn't get kicked out of office by the teabaggers next election. That's all it is.
Even the issue is not the undocumented. Even the issue is that the 50 million Americans, almost 50 million Americans that we have, who are born in this country, who right now don't have access to health care.
They are the issue.
Lose their houses because of medical bankruptcies. Those are our neighbors. We as a society, we can't afford, I believe, in my humble opinion, we can't afford to let our neighbors fall through the cracks.
Exactly. I believe that we will see a lot of important social change as a result of this. There are going to be consequences, unintended consequences that are very positive. Someone just introduced a bill in California. Did you hear about the soda tax? This is, Dean Flores introduced soda tax legislation in California last month. And what it does is it charges Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola a penny for every teaspoon of sugar in a drink. That means 17 cents on a 20-ounce soda, because a 20-ounce soda has 17 teaspoons of sugar in it, which is insane. But it's a great, hey, it's 17 cents. So you could take that money and use it to pay for a lot of health care, actually. And that's what this bill does, is it actually puts the money into childhood obesity prevention. So it's a nice circular thing. It's like the cigarette tax that was put into the quit smoking initiatives about 20 years ago when I was first in practice. We had a lot of money to help people quit smoking, and it was coming from the cigarette tax. So there's a lovely poetic justice. And another place where maybe this sort of thing will see positive change is in how cities are planned. You know, maybe we could plan our cities more like Europe, where there's a little shopping center that you can walk to where you can buy your food and your vegetables and your meat and your bread. And the only place to walk to is the 7-Eleven or the liquor store, where all they've got are snacks and prepared foods. Mm. And little parks, you know, scattered around. So change the zoning laws, change the city plans. And in 20 or in 10, but certainly in 20 years, if you change the city planning, then you will see a different city, and that city will be more health promoting rather than the current situation where the cities are very health demoting. And if the government sees itself as having a stronger interest because there's a financial interest, I think that the government itself will push harder for things like zoning changes and city planning changes that support health.
I hope, and I want to let other colleagues too.
But I
invite everyone to look at outside of their house, outside of their city in the States, and look at Europe. Look at Europe, because we have many things to learn from the Europeans, and one of them is healthcare. It's not perfect, don't get me wrong. We have many things that don't work either in our healthcare systems. I think it's better for the country, it's better for the community to have healthcare available for everyone.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Appreciate the call. And keep
You're
listening.
Welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going to our next callers in just a minute, but I wanted to also comment two related stories to what we've been talking about. The first one is that last week, President Obama had a physical. And of course, we have more information than we really want about the president, including that on his physical, he had prostate cancer screening and a virtual colonoscopy. You could argue that the president of the United States is going to get the best health care that tax dollars can buy. The question in my mind is, was a virtual colonoscopy the right way to go? Was that an appropriate test? I won't ask, was it cost effective? But if they'd found a polyp, they would have had to have put the president through another procedure in order to find out whether it was cancerous or not. Might have been better just to do the colonoscopy, even if that meant sedating the quote-unquote leader of the free world. The other thing, the prostate exam in a man President Obama's age, a PSA test, well, most people would say probably not necessary or even prudent to do that. There's a lot of argument about whether we should be giving PSAs in 50-year-old men, and I've been giving an informed consent, talking about the pluses and minuses of that when I do physicals for, gosh, years. My take on PSAs, just by the by, is if I have already got one data point in a man, then I recommend getting another PSA. If I don't have any previous PSAs and the man is young with no family history, I counsel him careful about whether or not you want to open Pandora's box, given the data that we have, that we're not really prolonging people's lives. And another related story, just to keep numbers, you know, this show's about a lot of numbers. So $30 billion is what is spent in the United States on plastic surgery. This is me doing the math, but essentially the number of plastic surgery procedures done in 2009, 1.5 million in the United States. And we're talking about tummy tucks, facelifts, breast implants, and other plastic surgeries. I estimated about $15,000 per procedure. And if you work out the math, that works out to $30 billion, roughly 10% of the cost of providing health care to everyone in the country per year. That would be health care for all paid for just off the top. So what do you think? Interesting little thought. Back to what Pedro was saying about national health in Europe. One of the things that Europe has is it has a basic minimum standard for everybody, and then it has a free market healthcare system. So if you believe me, there are plastic surgeons and very fancy hospitals that you can go to get your facelift in France, in Spain, and people pay for that out of pocket, and everybody is fine with that because the idea is that everybody deserves to eat, but you don't necessarily deserve filet mignon. Everybody deserves basic health care, but you don't necessarily deserve a facelift. And I don't know why we couldn't do that here. And I don't really think that the people who are lobbying so hard, with the exception of health insurance companies, I don't think doctors and hospitals are going to be losers here. I think they're going to be major winners. And it bothers me when I don't see the kind of support that this bill and the concept actually of health care for everyone, universal care, I don't see it getting the kind of support from hospitals and major doctors groups that I think it should. And that's a tisk tisk to them. Let's do some medicine. Let's talk to Brant in Santa Cruz. Hello, Brant. Welcome to the program.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
So I was out climbing on some rocks yesterday and fell and tweaked my ankle. So I'm trying to get some guidance about at what point you make the decision to go in and have an x-ray and that sort of thing.
Oh, okay.
It's still a little swollen. It's the interior ankle, interior leg ankle joint. It's mm-hmm. still a little swollen. It is responding to ice.
Mm-hmm.
When I injured it yesterday, I was able to walk on it fine. I mean, there was some pain depending upon what position it was in, but I was able to walk out of the woods and stuff, so... it's just because the swelling is still going on that I'm not sure what I should be doing at this point.
All right. Let me tell you about the results of national healthcare in Canada led to people asking just this question. You know, when you have a coordinated system and you can keep data, you can data mine it and you can figure out what the right thing to do is. And so this, brought to us by the Canadian government, is the Ottawa Ankle Rules. Ottawa spelled like Ottawa, Canada.
Okay.
You can look that up. You can Google it. You'll find, you know, hundreds of websites that will discuss it. But in a nutshell, the Ottawa Ankle Rules are a set of guidelines saying that if you don't have A, B, and C, then you don't need to do an X-ray because the probability of there being a fracture is so low to be negligible, so you can avoid the X-ray. So first one is you take the foot out and you feel along the outside part of the foot, that is to say the pinky side of the foot, where the bone, the metatarsal head is, which is roughly two-thirds of the way back from the toe, there's a big bone that sticks out. And you can feel the bump there, and that should not be tender. If that's tender, then you get an X-ray. If it's not tender, you go to the next one.
Okay.
And the next one is that you feel along the fibula, which is the bone on the outside of the leg that goes from the knee to the ankle. And you go about, two, 3 inches up from the bony protrusion of the ankle and put your thumb over the fibula, put your fingers over the other side, and give it a good hard squeeze. And it shouldn't hurt at the ankle.
Okay.
If it hurts at the ankle or it hurts anywhere along the outside of the leg, then you get an X-ray.
How high up is that?
Go up so you're above the swelling and above where you're sore.
Right, okay.
So get into a place where you, when you push with your thumb, it doesn't hurt.
Right.
And then give it a squeeze.
Okay.
And when you give it a good hard squeeze, you're bending the fibula a little bit. If there's a fracture, a spiral fracture of the fibula, a crack on the fibula anywhere, then you'll stretch that crack and you will feel pain.
Okay. Would it be a sharp pain, not a dull sort of pain?
Yeah. No. Well, it should be significant pain.
Okay.
With a good push. All right. Then the third thing is, was the person able to weight bear immediately afterwards? And that's the key, because immediately afterwards, if you can stand up and walk on it, even with pain, then that means you probably didn't break anything or tear it completely loose.
Okay.
But give it half an hour, and it's going to start swelling.
Right.
And it may hurt way too much after 2 hours of inflammatory mediators wandering around in there for you to be able to stand on it.
Okay.
But if you can stand on it right after, you know, within a couple of minutes, let's say, you can get up and stand and walk, some pain, then you're probably okay.
Okay.
So at that point, you've passed the Ottawa Ankle Rules test, and you don't have to go and get an X-ray.
Okay.
And in a sane culture, that's where you stop. They did successfully promote this to doctors and cut down on the X-ray rate, but people still wimp out and do it if the patient demands it, because they really, you know, I remember once I got sued. It was so funny. This really made an impression on me, though, so I want people to understand the culture of getting named in a lawsuit. A colleague of mine, patient had sprained her ankle. She actually had a fracture, and it was missed. It was missed by the doctor who saw her and got an X-ray, and it was missed by the radiologist who read the X-ray. So the patient went off thinking she didn't have a fracture, just a sprained ankle. And, yeah, she really pushed it. I mean, she overused it. She didn't follow instructions. She didn't wear her brace, et cetera, et cetera. She felt that, well, it's just a sprain, I'm tough, and she took pain meds and toughed it out. Unfortunately, she did have a fracture, and so she didn't get better. And a month later, when she came back in, still with significant ankle pain, the fracture was much more apparent on X-ray, and she was really, really mad at me for finding that fracture. When she sued all of us, including me, who I felt was an innocent bystander. I'm the one who said, oh, yeah, there's a fracture there. Here, we need to do this, that, and the other thing. Completely unreasonable. You know, she was just angry. But that's what happens. One experience like that in my life 15 years ago, and I hesitate to apply the Ottawa Ankle Rules. Part of me wants to get the X-ray so that I can't be accused of being negligent by an angry patient. And until such time as we have Ottawa Ankle Rules for everything and we have demonstrated a history of backing the doctor up in our legal system such that when someone tries to sue you for following those guidelines, they get laughed out of the lawyer's office, we're going to have a problem containing costs.
Okay.
So, sorry, just had to do a little editorializing.
That's okay. I think you need to do it anyway.
Yes, I'm ventilating. It's therapy for me.
Okay. Well, going by those rules, only one of them has any possible applicability, and that's the fibula issue. And it's sore going up, but I'm not going through the roof of pain.
Okay. Well, get somebody else with big, strong hands and go about 3 inches down from the knee.
Oh, okay.
And have them do it on both sides really hard and compare the two sides.
And that'll
be your tiebreaker.
Okay. Cool. And so swelling isn't really any indicator one way or the other.
You could have like a softball down there connected to your foot,
mm-hmm.
and it wouldn't necessarily mean anything. And by the way, you'll also have some really interesting bruising in a day or two.
Yeah, I smacked my tailbone yesterday, too, so I'm sure.
Well, you'll have lots of interesting bruising.
I have all sorts of it.
You know, you can tell your fortune by reading the shapes in your bruises.
Now, that's an interesting thing. It'd be more interesting than tea leaves, for sure.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, cool. All right, great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We had an off-air question. What do you know about the negative aspects of Gardasil for HPV? Ah, yes, and criticisms of the HPV vaccine. Well, basically, to answer that question, and I had another, actually, email around Gardasil, so let's do both of them at the same time. This was email from Dean in Santa Cruz, so let me read it. Gardasil for men over 26. I'm a man, age 40. I became sexually active back in the bad old days when HIV was a death sentence and was thus very diligent with barrier methods of safe sex. He goes on to give some personal details, which I will skip, but basically, he's going through a divorce now, and he strongly believes that he is HPV naive for at least one and probably several of the strains, and he's wanting to get the vaccination, which is the Gardasil vaccine. But he's been having trouble finding a physician that is not prohibited from dispensing by the policies of their medical group. That would tell me, Dean, that you're going to big outfits and not to small private practices like my own, where the Gardasil on demand is our policy. The thing about it is your health insurance won't pay for it if it's off-label due to your age or your sex. And so many large groups don't want to deal with non-standard payment. They don't want to take your cash. They don't want to get into a situation where they are billing you and trying to chase you to pay for an expensive vaccine that they've already given you. So they just close the door and say, okay, we're only giving it where we can plausibly get paid, which I think is not a good reason. With respect to the safety, when Gardasil is given to young girls between the ages of 11 and 26, a lot of them faint. Well, guess what? When you give vaccinations to young ladies with low blood pressure, a lot of them faint. That's a side effect of the vaccine in a sense, but it's not because of anything in the vaccine. It's more about the act of giving it. Most of the adverse reactions to Gardasil that have been reported can be attributed to drop in blood pressure. And there have been, I think, very little credible evidence of significant problems with this vaccine, but there is a lot of urban legend out there. I think it's as perfectly safe as any vaccine that we've got, and a lot of effort has gone into making it safe. And I solidly recommend Gardasil. There is a new HPV vaccine that's come out that does not contain the venereal warts components, but does claim to have some resistance against the less common secondary strains of HPV that also cause cervical cancer. I believe that it's too soon to say whether it will reduce the rate of cervical cancer more than Gardasil, but in the long run, we may find ourselves using both vaccines, and at least it's good to know that there may, and I want to emphasize, may be superiority in a vaccine that would protect against the strains that Gardasil does not. So, too soon to tell, but something I'm hopeful about. Let's go now to Jeff in Marina. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, what can I do for you?
Well, I have what I understand is a pretty common thing. When I sleep, and I sleep on my side, which is my preferred position, my fingers fall asleep.
All of them?
Well, it starts with my pinky and then my ring finger, and then it sort of spreads, and it usually doesn't get to my thumb or forefinger because it wakes me up.
Okay. I think that it's not circulation, but pressure on the nerve at your elbow, the ulnar nerve. And between the mattress and your body, the ulnar nerve is getting compressed. So,
I see.
So I have a fix for you.
Hooray.
Very old-fashioned kind of, you know, I love the old country doctor fixes, you know. So this is on the level of Vicks and flannel. So what you do is get yourself either an old leg warmer. If your wife was a disco diva and she's got some leg warmers kicking around in the attic, they'll work perfectly. Otherwise, a nice, soft, bulky sweater that you don't use anymore. And you cut the sleeve off and cut the cuff off, and you're left with a long knitted tube. And then you fold that over, and then you fold it over again, and maybe a third time. And what you'll end up with if you do that is you'll end up with a donut, very soft and maybe 3 or 4 inches long.
Huh.
You visualizing this with me?
I am. Okay. It's like a cushy koozie for your elbow.
Bingo. And you wear that at night. Hmm. And I bet that you will not wake up.
And I'm a terribly light sleeper to begin with, so this is very disruptive.
I bet. No, I really think you're just putting pressure on the ulnar nerve, and this is a very common problem, extremely common also in people who, now that we're doing so much keyboarding and typing and mousing, and we're so stressed out, that combination actually does tend to lead to a lot of tightness at the elbow. And oddly enough, there's a five elements Chinese medicine kind of correlation to that. I just think it's so cool when I find something that's in a 2,000-year-old textbook and they describe a certain situation and say, well, when this happens and this situation is present, you know, use these needles and do this. But I love it that we have a completely alternative explanation, and they're both true as far as we can tell, because if you do either treatment, the person gets better.
Right.
So they both work.
Well, you nailed it. I'm at the computer 8 hours a day. While I take frequent breaks and stretch and everything, I bet that's a contributing factor.
Yeah.
So I'll try the sweater donut.
And don't let anybody operate on your elbow, whatever you do.
No, oh, no.
Because
no. I would rather just sleep on my back.
Yeah, there's this cubital tunnel release surgery that a couple of people who became my patients after they had it done, because anybody who asks me, I'm like, no, back away slowly.
Well, I've survived 45 years as a very active person without a single surgery, so I wouldn't change that now.
Why don't we just get you an unnecessary surgery to celebrate your 65th birthday when you get into Medicare, huh?
No, thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Don. Bye-bye.
Let's talk to Claudia in Hollister. Hello, Claudia. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Dr. Don. First of all, I want to thank you for your comments on health care. I definitely think the human right. And also thank you to Dr. Pedro, and I'm going to be looking him up because of people that I work with who will probably need him. And my question to you is about omega-3.
Okay.
I also know of all the great benefits of omega-3, and I've tried it myself. Now, personally, I had an interesting reaction to that. My doctor recommended 1,000 units or milligrams.
Milligrams.
And I took, you know, the pure form. It was Nordic something, et cetera. And I started to feel like diabetic symptoms. And I don't have diabetes or have had high sugar content.
What symptoms?
Nothing like that.
What symptoms exactly?
I was feeling very thirsty, like those unquenchable thirst and needing to urinate all the time. That's what I was feeling.
Mm.
Then I stopped taking it because I realized this didn't come on. And then it went away. And I tried to, instead of taking the 1,000 milligrams, to take just ground flax seeds. If I would take, let's say, 1 teaspoon, I wouldn't get the symptom. But if I would take 3 teaspoons of ground, you know, heaped, then it was approximating. So it seemed like an issue of dosage. So I was puzzled by this. My doctor had never heard it. I went to the internet and I checked what there might be a relationship between omega-3 and insulin. I found one site that said, do you want to lose weight, take omega-3 because it reduces your insulin. All the others didn't mention a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was very commercial, not the kind of site that I would necessarily go by. So I've been hearing your excellent program, and I wanted to hear your comments on it.
Well, I am very intrigued by what you describe, and I haven't come across this before clinically. And I'm wondering, I'm really wondering about the mechanism of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't got a good idea for you. It's just really intriguing. Do you have any kind of food sensitivities or food allergies that you know of?
Not really.
Claudia, you got me. You got me stumped. I don't understand why you would have these symptoms. They may not have anything to do with diabetes, by the way, but they do sound like a reproducible physiological reaction to taking the omega-3s, and given that omega-3s will get into your body and essentially permeate the cell walls of everything, it's plausible that it could have some sort of effect. The other thought that comes to mind is that it's something else, either in the capsule. Some of the Nordic Naturals products contain flavoring, and it might be that you're reacting to the flavoring, although that's a bit far-fetched as well. I really don't have a good answer for you, but if your body gives you such an unequivocal thing like that, what I would suggest you do is just do it with diet. So if you were to consume, say, small fish, sardines or herring, if you can figure out a way to eat sardines or herring, they're not going to have much mercury because they're itty-bitty fishies, and they are excellent sources of omega-3. And if you just had, let's say, two servings of those a week and maybe another serving of fish a week, you would be getting a good level of omega-3 from the fish.
Yes, and you know, I do a lot of, I drink a lot of olive oil. So as to omega-3s, I know now that I can handle at least 1 or 2 teaspoons of flaxseed. Well, it just the thing intrigued me. So when I heard your program, I thought I'd call, and maybe you don't.
Doesn't ring a bell, but I'll look it up. Yeah,
another program.
Yeah,
you might instruct people. Okay.
All right, I'll try to find out something about it. Off the top of my head, really at a loss for mechanism. But thank you very much for presenting me with an intriguing problem, and I'll follow up.
Well, I thank you very much. This is a great program.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I wanted to thank Blaze, actually, in Santa Cruz for his email. He sent us a International Fish Oil Standards site, which also talks about the criteria for fish oil, and it listed a bunch of different products. And the Nordic Naturals product that Claudia referred to did get 5 stars. One of the criteria that they use is PCB levels less than 50% of the CRN standard. And I don't know what the CRN standard is. I don't know what those initials stand for. But nevertheless, I thought that it was a good website, and we will post a link in the ever-growing fish oil section of the Ask Dr. Don website. And while we're on the topic, let me remind you that there is a lot of good information there on the website, not just the archived programs going back now almost 5 years. And if you haven't explored the archives and the interviews, please do. There's some really, really high-level people there and some good, solid information, definitely out-of-the-box thinkers and kind of fun, I think. CRN stands for Council for Responsible Nutrition. Thank you, Charlie, for that clarification. Let's see. We've got just enough time, I think, to do a few late stories. And let's talk about something interesting. Sleep. We all like to talk about sleep. This was a study at the University of California, Berkeley, on a learning test designed to see if a nap could be helpful in making you more productive. What they did was they gave 2 groups of adults a learning test, and it was designed to stimulate a part of the brain critical to short-term memory. And then a couple of hours after taking the test, one group was allowed to nap for 90 minutes and the other group continued to work. And then at 6 p.m., they did the test again, and they found that the group that had napped scored markedly better than the group that hadn't napped, suggesting that sleep reboots the brain, helping clear short-term memory and shuttle key information into long-term storage. You came up with a great metaphor. It's as though the email inbox is full, and until you sleep and clear out those spam emails, you're not going to receive any more mail. So if you're having to learn things, let's do a little nap before you settle down to try and cram for that test, and maybe a little nap before you take the test as well. And we've got, I don't think we can do very much, but let me just tell you a really, really hopeful story. We can do that in 1 minute. Stroke patients who've lost the ability to speak can be taught to speak again by having them sing. The strokes that damage the brain's left hemisphere prevent people from speaking. At Harvard, neurologists find that if they teach people to sing what they want to say, it's called melodic intonation therapy. Of course, they have to give it a fancy name. But if you teach them to sing what they want to say, I need to go to the bathroom now, to the bathroom now, you know, that kind of thing, people actually start to be able to talk. And after several years of singing everything they want to say, new speech centers seem to arise in the brain, and they're able to convert the sing-songy talk into normal speech. This is amazingly good news for the some 60,000 patients every year who are left unable to speak after a stroke. So don't be surprised if you hear people singing to you in the next few years as this form of speech therapy catches on. I find that just extremely interesting and exciting. And I want to thank you all for listening. It's been a lovely show, and I hope that you will continue to take social action to reshape this crazy situation we're in. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.